February 21st, 1977, Chicago, Illinois. Firefighters and police are called to the scene of an apartment on fire. When they battle their way through the smoke on the 15th floor, they put out a blaze of clothing and a mattress. Underneath the mattress was 48-year-old Teresita Basa, a respiratory therapist originally from the Philippines, dead with a butcher knife still wedged in her chest. When police had zero leads, something supernatural happened, and Teresita took matters into her own hands. This is the bizarre and true story of Teresita Basa, the woman who solved her own murder. Hey, y'all, I'm Chris Calvert.
And I'm her husband, Rob Potterworth. Welcome to Hitch to Homicide.
For better or worse.
Till death do us part.
Welcome back, everybody.
Yes, welcome, welcome, welcome. And for our friends in the Chickasaw Nation.
Oh, I like it when you do Native American languages.
All right. Chokma, Chokma, Chokma.
Very nice.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that if that's exactly welcome, but it's a greeting. So anyone that actually speaks the Chickasaw language, if I got it wrong, I apologize.
So what you're saying is that the military's never going to call you to be a wind talker.
No.
Although that was Navajo, I know.
Yeah, my wind talker days are done.
Well, wherever you are listening, be sure to like and rate and review the podcast.
Yep.
You can subscribe to it wherever you're listening to it right now. And if you're watching on YouTube, hit that subscribe button below.
Please do.
You can find us on Instagram at Hitch to Homicide or on X at H2H_podcast. And if you want true crime all the time, please join our closed Facebook group, The In-Laws and Outlaws.
Mm-hmm.
Go to Facebook and type in H2H In-Laws and Outlaws, answer a few questions, and you're in. There's over 1,000 of us in there.
I know. It's growing.
Go join.
Yep.
We're lots of fun.
Yep.
Just ask us.
Yeah, just ask us.
I know I sound, it's like a broken record at the beginning of each podcast. I just want to get it all in there.
Oh, yeah.
Get everything in there so everybody knows.
Yep.
This case is crazy. I really was drawn to it because of the paranormal aspect of it.
Right.
We should have, in hindsight, asked Catherine Kaufman, our H2H resident psychic medium,
mm-hmm.
about this. Maybe we can get her to chime in The In-Laws and Outlaws.
Yeah.
But just wait till you hear this.
Okay.
Just wait till you hear this case. Before I get started, let me thank some sources. The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, History.com, Medium.com, Grunge.com, Wickedness.net, Find a Grave, Unsolved Mysteries, and the Filipino edition of Esquire magazine.
All right. Well, you ready?
I am.
Let's do it.
Teresita Basa, her family, I believe, called her Cheetah,
okay.
was born in the Philippines in 1929 in Dumaguete City, Negros, Oriental Province, Central Visayas.
How would you like to have that address?
Dumaguete City. Her early life is really a gray area, but there are sources that claim she was a member of a Filipino aristocracy and that her parents were very wealthy.
Okay.
She graduated from Assumption College in Manila. She was a concert pianist who came to the United States in the 1960s to study music at Indiana University.
Oh, look at that.
Indiana, IU. Oh, Indiana.
Had a lot of friends that went to IU Music School.
She went there to pursue her master's degree.
Hmm.
But somehow she ended up studying respiratory therapy because that's what she became, a respiratory therapist, who left Bloomington, Indiana and headed to Chicago for a job. I read in a Chicago Tribune article, she was a world traveler.
Oh.
Now, a lot about Teresita's past, again, is hazy, but what we do know is that in 1977, she was working as a respiratory therapist at Edgewater Hospital in Chicago and living in a high-rise apartment on the north side of Chicago at 2740 North Pine Grove Avenue in Lincoln Park.
Okay.
She's back in school in Chicago, this time at Loyola University, where she was preparing a thesis for her doctorate in music.
Oh, wow.
In addition to working at the hospital and working on her PhD, she was giving piano lessons in her apartment to kids in the neighborhood.
So she was an underachiever, is basically what you're
saying. And she was writing her own book.
Oh my God. Wow. I feel inadequate all of a sudden.
She did have a boyfriend. I couldn't seem to find his name, but he was an on-again, off-again relationship.
Gotcha.
Teresita was a devout Catholic, and although by the time 1978 rolls around, she's 48 years old, she has never married, and she is a virgin. Mm. That's called foreshadowing.
Uh-oh. You ready, Scotty? Here we go.
Exactly. I kind of heard him go, in there. But Teresita doesn't party. She doesn't drink. She doesn't party. She's a straight-edge lady.
Okay.
On February 21st, 1977, Teresita worked a shift at the Edgewater Hospital, and when she was finished for the day, she went home to her apartment. At around 7:30 p.m., she took a phone call from her good friend at the hospital, Ruth Loeb. These two talked for about 20 minutes, and during the conversation, Teresita mentions that she had a male guest coming over, but she didn't say anything more, and Ruth didn't ask any more questions. What Ruth didn't know was that earlier that day, Teresita had spoken to a respiratory therapy assistant about helping her fix her television set. His name is Alan Showery.
Okay.
In fact, Alan had helped Teresita with a few handyman honeydew items in her apartment. That list gets long sometimes, doesn't it, honey?
I always have my honeydew list.
Rob's got a long honeydew list.
I'll get to it someday.
Yeah, someday. But Alan had helped Teresita with a few handyman things in her apartment, and she paid him really well. Mm-hmm. And I think she paid him well because she knew he needed the money.
Right.
Alan lived with his girlfriend, who he'd had for 7 years. Her name is Janka Kamluk. She's from Germany.
Okay.
And Janka was pregnant.
Okay.
That night on February 21st, 1977, Alan did in fact come to Teresita's apartment to fix the television set. But apparently when he arrived, he didn't have the right tools. And as luck would have it, Alan and Janka lived nearby. According to Alan, it's on this walk back to his house that he decides he's going to rob and kill Teresita.
Really?
He goes back to her apartment on the 15th floor, and when Teresita opens the door for him, she lets him back in. She turns around, locks the door, and while her back is turned, Alan strangled her until she stopped screaming. Hmm. Then he stabbed her in the chest with a butcher knife. He ransacked the apartment, thinking that Teresita had lots of money stashed in her apartment. She, in fact, did not. He found $30, and he took that and some of Teresita's jewelry. But before he left, he stripped Teresita's body of all her clothes and posed her to make it look like she had been raped. Hmm. He wanted police to think it was a rape and burglary.
Sure.
Then he pulled the mattress off of her bed and covered her with it, setting it and her clothes on fire before walking out the door.
Wow.
Around 8:40 p.m. that night, neighbors Merid and Catherine Naz smell smoke. They couldn't figure out where it was coming from, so they called the building's supervisor, the janitor, and he in turn got in touch with the Chicago Fire Department, and he called all the tenants and said, get out.
Right.
And the fire trucks arrive, and they continue to evacuate the residents, and smoke filled the hallway of the 15th floor. And the firemen were able to pretty easily decide, oh, it's apartment 15B that's on fire.
Sure.
The 27-year-old janitor, Petro Lulusa, let the firemen in with his passkey, and they discovered that the smoke was coming from a pile of clothing smoldering on the bedroom floor.
Mm-hmm.
They put out the fire. Then as they're searching, after they've got everything under control, they look under the mattress, and Teresita Bassa is laying on her back, nude, with a wooden handle butcher knife still lodged in her chest.
Ooh.
The firemen and police who arrived soon after think, well, she's been raped. But when the medical examiner performs an autopsy, he tells police, not only was she not raped, but Teresita was a virgin.
Mm.
Now, the case had no known suspects. There were no fingerprints. It's given to police detectives Joseph Stakula and his partner Lee Eplin. He questions, Joseph Stakula, he questions her on again, off again boyfriend.
Right.
But apparently he had an airtight alibi and he's cleared right away.
Okay.
Teresita's colleagues tell Detective Stakula that everyone loved Teresita and she didn't have any enemies. She lived a quiet life, and most of her belongings were destroyed in the fire, but there was one piece of evidence, one. It was a handwritten note Teresita wrote to herself, which read, "Get theater tickets for A.S."
Okay.
Two initials, A.S.
All right.
2 months later, in April of 1977, police put the case aside, and they just mark it as a cold case. They're at a dead end. They don't have anywhere else to go with this.
Sure.
For 5.5 months, there's no movement in this case. That is until one woman has a vision. Remy Chua was a fellow respiratory therapist at Edgewater Hospital. And although these two were both respiratory therapists there, they knew who the other was, but they never worked the same shift and they weren't really friends. Remy could only really remember meeting her once 2 years prior at an orientation at the hospital.
Okay.
Now, Remy and her husband, Dr. Jose Chua, he's a surgeon. They live outside the city in Evanston, Illinois, which is where Northwestern University is located.
Oh.
But after Teresita's murder, Remy says out loud one day that she wouldn't mind Teresita's spirit visiting her to tell her what happened.
Mm.
And buddy, that apparently was the green light that the spirit world needed to get on the celestial phone.
Open that door.
Because not long after this, Remy Chua starts having visions and nightmares.
Really?
Yep. It all starts in the locker room at the hospital. Remy went into the locker room to rest her eyes. She lays down on the couch. This is a thing at hospitals, too. When you have really long shifts, if you get a break and you go into the break room and the couch is empty, you're probably going to find somebody. If it's empty, you're lucky.
Yeah.
You might see somebody laying on the couch, and that's exactly what she's doing. There's nobody in there. She lays on the couch. She just wants to close her eyes for a few minutes.
Okay.
But as she begins to drift off to sleep, she feels like someone's in the room with her, even though no one has opened the door.
Okay.
Now, this is a thing. This is a paranormal thing. People will say sometimes that they feel like they're being watched.
Right.
And that's what she feels like. She feels like there's somebody in the room with her.
Okay.
When she opens her eyes, she sees clearly a woman. She sees Teresita Basa staring at her.
Wow.
At first, she thinks, I'm dreaming. This is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But then she realizes that she's awake. And after she has this vision, Remy starts having nightmares where she sees Teresita again, but behind her is a man. Then one night, while Remy is sitting with her husband in the living room, she gets up without explanation, and she walks to their bedroom, and she lays down. And Dr. Chua follows her because he's worried. He finds her on the bed with a blank stare on her face. He asks his wife if anything is wrong. Is something wrong?
Right.
And according to Dr. Chua, his wife spoke, but it wasn't her voice.
What?
She was speaking in Tagalog, which is the national language of the Philippines.
No.
But she had a strange Spanish-like accent.
Really?
So he does what any doctor would do. He starts asking her questions like, what's your name?
Yeah.
You know, do you know where you are? Can you tell me your name? That kind of stuff.
Sure.
And she replies in this strange voice in Tagalog, Aki A, which is I am Teresita Basa.
Wow.
Dr. Chua doesn't know a Teresita Basa at all. But this voice out of his wife's mouth keeps going and says, quote, Alan Showery arrived alone at the apartment at 7 p.m.
No way.
End quote.
No way.
She says that Teresita let him in. And Dr. Chua at this point is really asking questions. Quote, why did she let him in? End quote. And his wife says he was her friend. They were alone together and he stabbed her. End quote.
Wow.
30 minutes later, Remy snaps out of her trance, and she didn't even remember leaving the front room of their house, the living room. And according to Dr. Chua, after it was over, she was incredibly thirsty. That was really the only thing that happened after. She was confused, and she was incredibly thirsty.
Hmm.
When he tells his wife what she said, they decide, well, this is too crazy. It's too crazy of a story. We can't tell anybody this. Nobody's going to believe us.
Yeah.
But then it happened again.
Really?
And this time the voice pleads with Dr. Chua to help her. But Dr. Chua, now remember, this guy's a very respected surgeon, right?
Sure.
Dr. Chua says, we need evidence. You got to tell us more.
Right.
And she tells him that Alan had taken her jewelry, something that the police didn't know.
Wow.
And that he had given part of the jewelry to his girlfriend.
Whoa.
So at this point, Dr. Chua is like, I got to tell somebody about this.
Yeah.
So at the hospital, he tells his colleagues, and everyone's thinking, I don't know if you should take this to the police.
You might want to keep this to yourself.
You might just want to keep this to yourself. Yeah. It just sounds too far-fetched. It's way too far-fetched.
Yeah.
And then a third time, Remy goes into this trance-like state where she tells Dr. Chua to call the police.
Mm.
So they call the police in Evanston, who in turn call the Chicago PD. And they're like, you gotta hear this one.
Yeah. It's like in Anchorman. This is a big one.
This is a big one. Yeah. It's like, you're not going to believe this.
Yeah.
So Detective Stakula calls the Evanston police and they give him Dr. and Mrs. Chua's information, and he heads to the burbs and a really nice house to interview them.
Mm-hmm.
And when Detective Stakula gets there, he says they seemed totally embarrassed.
Yeah.
So he, quote, put it right to them. I told them we'd been notified that they possessed certain information, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Chua asks him, do you believe in the occult or in exorcism or anything like that? And the detective is like, what?
Yeah. What have I gotten myself into?
Dr. Chua goes on to say that he's been trained to accept lots of things that can't be explained. And that's true. Doctors will say, I have no idea what happened.
Right.
Yeah. But what happened to his wife and in his own home was so bizarre that he was hesitant to come forward and say anything.
Sure.
He tells the detective that he's never heard of Teresita Bassa, and he wasn't even aware that she'd been murdered until his wife Remy went into this trance.
Right.
He tells the detective that the name she has given them is Alan Showery.
Okay.
And that he has Teresita's jewelry. And he says there's a jade necklace and there's a pearl ring.
Hmm.
This is Dr. Chua, tells him that.
See, the thing I would be afraid of is that if I were the detective, I'd go, all right, these guys have something to do with this.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I think he thinks because they live in a completely different part of town and they're a very well-respected couple.
Right.
That there's no way they would have anything to do with this.
Yeah.
But hold that thought.
All right.
So the detective asked the one question that really only the police and the medical examiner know.
Mm-hmm.
Did she say she'd been raped? And Dr. Chua said, quote, she only said she had been stabbed, end quote.
Okay.
So, of course, police are like, it's our only lead.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it sounds crazy, Alan Showery has the same initials as she left on her note, A.S., buy theater tickets for A.S.
Right.
Yeah. Teresita wrote this to herself, get theater tickets for A.S.
I remember that.
So they go to the hospital and they start asking around, and what they learn from Teresita's work buddies is that she had told them she was meeting Alan that night, the night she was murdered, that he was coming over to fix her television set. So Detective Sekhula and Eplin go back to the office and they tell the other detectives what they've just learned. And the guys in the precinct start making fun of them.
Yeah.
They would throw paper clips across the room and act like a ghost did it. They would put messages in their box to call people who were dead. Cops really do have a sense of humor.
Yeah, they do.
When I did Citizens Police Academy, one thing I realized is that they're like a bunch of fraternity brothers, albeit frat boys who'll take a bullet for each other.
Yeah.
But they really do like to joke around, and some of them are pretty funny too.
Sure.
When I got shot in the head, mind you, in a drug raid because I didn't check behind the door.
Wait, let's clarify that. You really didn't get shot. It was a mock
The mock drug raid.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, I got shot in the head.
Yeah.
Because I didn't check behind the door, my blind spot, and they all thought it was pretty damn funny. I thought it was so hot, like I was kicking open doors and shouting, police! Yeah.
That's kind of fun stuff you get to do when you do the police academy.
Yes, but I finished and I went into the classroom and a group of officers were like, how'd you do? And I said, well, I'm dead. And one of them looked at me and goes, you didn't clear your blind spot, did you?
Oops.
Like, nope, I didn't. Of course, they all laughed.
You had one job.
You had, yeah. All you had to do was clear. Well, you're clearing rooms. I mean, I was kicking open doors and shouting and stuff, but I walked into a room and the door was open and he was behind the door. And he got me right in the head.
Oops.
My point is this.
Okay. Yet I digress.
The detectives Strakula and Eplin are getting razzed a little bit because their biggest lead is a woman who's been possessed by the spirit of their dead victim and she's got answers.
Right.
Detective Strakula and Eplin do a records check on Alan and discover that he actually lives very close to Teresita's apartment. And on August 11th, they pay him a little visit in his second floor abode to ask him a few questions. Mm. And it's at this point that Alan admits that, yes, he knew Teresita, but he denied that he went to her apartment that night. But then he finds out that his work colleagues already told the police that she was planning on seeing him that night, the night she died.
Right.
And he changes his story to say, well, yeah, I mean,
I guess I did.
I went to her apartment to fix her television, but I left early in the evening. Hmm. Meanwhile, police pay a visit to Alan's common-law wife or girlfriend of 7 years.
Right.
They ask her if Alan had perhaps given her any jewelry in the past few months as a gift. Mm-hmm. And she says, why, yes. Got some jewelry. It was a late Christmas present.
Uh-oh.
So her name is Camluck, remember? She shows the jewelry to Tessarita's relatives. She's so certain that her boyfriend of 7 years, and she's pregnant, by the way, with his child. Mm-hmm. She's so certain that he didn't do anything bad that she shows the jewelry to Tessarita's relatives and friends. And they're like, whoa, that's hers.
Yeah.
And in fact, the detectives, when they first speak to her, they notice that she's wearing a pearl cocktail ring.
Wow.
And what did Tessarita say?
Yeah.
Jade necklace, pearl ring.
Yep.
So they get Alan alone and they tell him, look it, we know, and he sings like a canary.
Oh, really?
He confesses to the detectives and then he gives them a written confession telling them that he wanted to rob her because he needed money and she'd always hired him to do these odd jobs and she always paid him more than she should have. So he thinks she's rich, she's got money stashed in her apartment.
Yeah.
File this one under no good deed goes unpunished,
right.
Folks.
Yep.
He confessed that he really had gone to fix the TV and made a plan to return with a weapon. When he did return later that night, Teresita allowed him inside. She turned away. He grabbed her from behind and attacked her. He rendered her unconscious by strangling her, tore off her nightgown to make it appear as if there had been a sexual assault, and then stabbed and covered the body with a mattress. Then he lit her clothes and the mattress on fire. Mm-hmm. Alan Showery gets an attorney. His name is William Swano. And it's at this point he recants his confession, both of them, saying that the police coerced him into making the confession because they told him they were going to put his pregnant girlfriend, Yanka Camluck, into jail as an accessory to murder. Uh-huh. Now, this whole thing is going to go to trial.
Right.
And the defense is saying, Mr. DA, surely you're not going to hang your hat on a woman channeling the spirit of the victim. And they said, no, we aren't. We're hanging our case on the fact that we know he was there that night and that he stole Teresita's jewelry, not to mention he confessed. Mm-hmm. Now, the media is calling this the Voice from Beyond the Grave trial. During the trial, Remy Chua and her husband, Dr. Jose Chua, take the witness stand telling the jury what they experienced. But get this. They testified not for the prosecution, but for the defense.
What?
Because Alan's attorney thinks that if he gets them up on the witness stand, that this testimony is going to discredit the case and they would believe his story that on the night of Teresita's murder, he had dinner at his girlfriend's house before he went drinking and playing darts with a neighbor, that he was never at Teresita's house.
Okay.
When he gets Remy on the stand, he's saying things like, "Did she speak through your lips?" And she says, "Yes." But William Suano, the attorney, he suggests to the court that Remy actually sold this jewelry to Alan and then said that it was stolen. And Remy says, "No, I didn't sell him anything." And he says that Remy doesn't like Alan because she thinks he made a crank call to her in July of 1977.
What? Okay.
A crank call.
Yeah.
And then he says that she only had the voice of Teresita in her head after she was let go from her job at the hospital, and that Alan had complained to their superiors that Remy wasn't doing a good job as a respiratory therapist.
Okay.
So he's saying, yeah, she's mad at me. She's framing me for this because I said she wasn't doing her job well and she lost her job.
Okay.
When it was all said and done, there were like 33 witnesses and the jury was hung like a Christmas wreath. Mm. And the case was nearly declared a mistrial when, much to the chagrin of his attorney, Alan Showery changed his plea to guilty with full knowledge that he was on the brink of being released.
Really?
And nobody knows what was going through his head. Maybe Teresita came to visit him and said, "Yo, dude, I'm coming for you."
So he had no explanation for why he changed his plea.
Yeah, it's a hung jury. They're ready just to like let the whole thing go. And he confesses. He says, "I was guilty."
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you imagine his lawyer?
Yeah, his attorney was mad.
Dude, shut up.
I'm sure that's what he was saying.
Yeah.
Alan Showery was sentenced to 4 years each for robbery and arson and 14 for murder. Mm. The terms were to run concurrent, meaning 14 years altogether. They would run side by side.
Right.
He would be eligible for parole after serving 7 years. And I think he was out after six. But I did also read that he was out after four.
After murdering somebody.
After murdering somebody.
Jeez.
By the way, there are lots of people who've tried to track Alan down after he was released. Mm-hmm. No one's been able to find him. Dr. Chua and his wife, Remy, didn't want any spotlight whatsoever.
Right.
But when the detectives decided to write a book, so did the husband and wife team, hiring their friend who was a doctor, a foot surgeon who'd written textbooks. That's going to be compelling stuff, by the way. Yeah.
There's illustrations. And
that's who they hired to write their story.
And footnotes.
Oh, but ba-dum-bum.
Thanks. I'll be here all week. Try the veal.
I knew you were going to say the veal line. Good Lord. But don't go looking for these books because they're all out of print and none of them are ebooks because I went looking. I was going to try to read one.
Right.
When Detective Strachula was asked how he felt about getting his tips from the grave or the great beyond, he said, quote, "I talk to pimps, prostitutes, and drug addicts. Dr. and Mrs. Chua are educated, intelligent people who live in a $90,000 house. It's a distinct change for me. I wanted information on this murder. I listened and acted on what they told me," end quote.
Wow.
And yes, in 1977, they lived in a $90,000 home. So that's probably like a $500,000 home now.
Sure.
But the detective, he went where the case took him.
Right.
Even though his buddies back at the precinct were ribbing him pretty hard about it.
Sure.
Teresita's body was taken back to the Philippines for her burial. So what do you think? Did she come back from the grave to solve her own murder?
Yeah, I mean, come on.
I don't know how this other woman, who'd really only met her once, somehow knew all of these things.
Yeah, exactly.
And they didn't want to come forward. And since they wrote their book, I mean, it's not in print anymore. They don't give interviews. She won't talk about it. They hated the three-ring circus that surrounded it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a surgeon.
Yeah.
She's a respiratory therapist. And they're like, we're going to look like idiots.
Right, right.
Getting up on the stand to say this. But that's what happened. And that's, we told the police. And then the police are like, well, that led us straight to him. And then he confessed.
Yeah.
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 But that is the case of Teresita Basa, the woman who ID'd her killer from beyond the grave. And that's all I have to say about that. She is only one, but what if one is all that's needed? Hospice nurse Indy Luce has fallen in love. After caring for billionaire Louis Thornberry until his final breath, she's now engaged to marry the heir apparent of the global tech empire, David Thornberry. But as the divinely marked Indy packs up her old life to begin anew, a sacred promise comes back to haunt her with a vengeance. As an unrelenting spiritual battle unfolds in the shadows, the descendants of those like Indy find themselves persistently lured and ensnared as a relentless surge of evil becomes an unstoppable force. With malevolent entities following her every step, what Indy doesn't know about her family's sacred covenant could tip the scales of good and evil. The follow-up to the paranormal suspense novel Lead Me From Temptation and book 2 of the Divine Darkness series Deliver Me From Evil is now available March 29th, 2024, wherever you buy or download books, or go to chriscalvert.com. If evil prowls seeking someone to devour, can one woman seek and save that which is lost?
Listen, there's things that happen every day in our lives that are unexplained.
Yeah.
So something like this, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I just want everybody out there to know I'm coming back to haunt somebody. I am. I got plans. I got plans for the afterworld, and I'm haunting all of y'all.
That's funny. Well, I'm glad that she came back from the grave.
It's just really interesting that she made sure that he was held responsible for her death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she came back from the grave. Let's see if we can find people that would come back from the stupid.
I love your segues. It's just one of the many reasons I love you.
With a little bless your heart. All right, this first one I'm calling initially stupid.
Okay.
A drunk who pulled out a knife in a bank was caught because his initials are tattooed on his face.
On his face?
On his face.
Okay.
Patrick Revens, 49, was tracked down in just 20 minutes and identified by the letter P and the letter R inked on his face.
People.
Yeah.
People.
Yep.
That's kind of like A.S. being on her note to herself.
Yeah. Now, Patrick, brandishing a large bread knife with an 8-inch blade in a branch of the Barclays Bank.
Is he going to saw something off? Because a bread
I know.
A bread knife's not that sharp on the end.
Well, he went into a Barclays Bank, and that's what the court heard, okay?
Okay.
So, 2 days later, he was stopped again carrying a bayonet and carving knife. Revens.
What? He upped his game.
Yep. Revens, who has a net tattooed to his forehead, was jailed for 27 months after admitting 3 charges of having an article with a blade or point. Yeah. Now, Judge Paul Glenn, he was the judge in the court, he told him, "You were unable to walk a straight line in the bank, no doubt due to drink or drugs. You plainly represent a danger to others." And he was sentenced.
He had a spider web on his forehead?
No, he had Annette. The name Annette is probably his girlfriend.
Annette. I thought you meant like he had a net.
No.
And I was going to say, it's not that net's not holding any brains inside. You mean a... Okay.
Well, I would love to see what Annette looks like.
Jeez. I'm sorry. I got that all wrong.
That's all right.
He had a net on his forehead.
He had a basketball hoop.
I thought he had a real net, not a net. Okay.
No. Okay. Number.
I'm glad we cleared it all up.
All right. Number 2. If I didn't have bad luck, I'd have no luck at all.
Oh, doom, despair, and agony on me.
You got it. The number was up for a bungling thief caught stealing registration plates from an unmarked police van. Yeah, the police van was involved in an undercover operation. Police had parked the van in a residential street while carrying out raids on a suspected brothel.
Oops.
And safe house.
Oh, my gosh.
But the hapless criminal had no idea It was a West Midlands police vehicle. Once again, this is over in the UK.
He's back there going,
yeah, exactly. Well, he helped himself to the numbered plates, all right?
You couldn't pick a worse van, man. I know.
Officers from an international police operation for targeting foreign criminals spotted the thief and gave chase. They watched him discard the plates nearby and arrested him on suspicion of theft and going equipped to steal.
So this makes me think of the case we just talked about where the officers are giving the detectives a hard time.
Yeah.
Can't you just see somebody calling into the van? Dude, they're stealing your place.
I know. Well, a source said, quote, he was well and truly in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
He couldn't have chosen a worse vehicle.
That's what I said. I say it here, it comes out there.
That's it, exactly.
What can I say? I still can't get past Annette.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, number three, and finally, well, that's going to leave a mark.
Okay.
Jamie Brown, 29, who was caught by cops who saw him crying in pain.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Brown spent 6 hours in agony at Leeds General Hospital before being discharged and appearing before the court.
Aw, bless his heart.
I know. The judge heard Brown had attempted to make off with a $250 fish tank, but as cops swarmed the area, Brown was hiding.
He's carrying the fish tank?
I guess. While he was hiding, he relieved himself in a bush that was unfortunately home to a nest of wasps. As he quickly fled from the crime scene, his fleeing panic caught the attention of police. Now, Brown pleaded guilty to a charge of theft, which the court heard breached a suspended sentence for a previous theft.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, the prosecuting attorney said the alarm was triggered and the police were called. Parking the car near the store, police saw the defendant running towards them. He was sweating heavily and rubbing his head.
I bet he was. Which head was he rubbing?
I know. He said he was running home and had been attacked by wasps. A witness said she saw him wearing gloves, which they later found with the fish tank.
If you're a man, is there a worse place to be stung by a wasp?
I don't know.
I'm
crossing my legs.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a bless your heart or you know somebody named Annette, I still can't believe I got that wrong. Go to hitchtohomicide.com where there's a pull-down menu. And while you're there, you can also suggest a case or tell us about any true crime story that you've been part of.
Yeah.
That's my amazing husband out there.
And that's my beautiful bride in the booth.
Join us next time on Hitch to Homicide.
Bye, y'all.